2 weeks ago, Time magazine inaugurated a new department labeled Behavior. If the editors had read Dr. May's work, they would have long ago recognized the excitement and great significance that the study of psychology has for all aspects of life. Consideration should be given to Dr. Mays as Time's Man of the Year, for he has been a bright and shining star in the area of psychotherapy for many years. Dr. May received his AB degree from Oberlin and his PhD from Columbia, and is no stranger to Michigan State, for he was a student here and also was on the staff. He is the author of many scientific papers and books and is currently a practicing psychoanalyst in New York City. The title of Dr. May's address is Paradoxes in Sexual Roles in America. Dr. Rollo May.
Mr. Peterson and Dr. Norell, I shall speak this afternoon as a psychoanalyst. We get data that, if not as broad as other data, is at least much deeper. And this I want to use to throw light upon the problem of sexual roles in America. That sexual roles are vastly changing, you don't need to be a psychoanalyst to see. Two people were sitting on a bench in a park in New York recently, and the person walked by. One said, that was a funny girl. And the other one said, that was no girl, that was my son. And the first one answered, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were its father. And the second person answered, no, I'm not, I'm its mother. Now, we know the androgynous tendencies of dress, of almost every kind of superficial difference of the sexes. And this is an important aspect of modern man's tremendous puzzlement about what it means to be a man or a woman, what sexual identity actually means. Now, I want to begin this afternoon by talking about the American experience of the myth of the frontier. This was the myth that had to do particularly with potency, the drive to repress the awareness of death and to assert oneself over life, to assert one's potency in sexual ways, in work, in all kinds of ways, is the background of most of us in this country. Now, I use the term myth here not at all in this popular sense of falsehood, but rather in a psychobiological sense of the pattern that gives power to our way of life and gives us our identity. The individual potency, which was our great concern in America on the frontier, was not only on the geographical frontier of the West, but was also on an economic frontier. The penniless person from the Central Europe could come on a ship and land at Ellis Island and believe that if he were strong enough, he could make himself into a rich man. Also, there's always been in our country a social frontier. A man who is born on the most nondescript kind of farm can, if he asserts himself, if he has the inner ability, can marry the rich man's daughter. Now, I want to take the geographical frontier of the West as our typical example. There it was crucial that a man be able to defend himself by the strength of his own hand, that he cultivate a rough and active type of physical strength, and that he not let tenderness or gentleness stiffen, slow his movement in the drawing of his gun. Indeed, the gun as a symbol for a male penis, used when it's stiff and erect. This was first pointed out by Freud, but this is one of the few cultural symbols that has remained not only true in America, but specifically true in this country. The life and legend of Ernest Hemingway provides a vivid picture of masculine potency. The need of Ernest Hemingway for active hunting, for The verbs always in his writing, the need of Hemingway to demonstrate his sexual prowess, which was always within him a struggle against sexual impotence, fear of sexual impotence that became actual at times. Now, these were all aspects of the potency of the modern American man. But impotence finally came to Hemingway in his later years, and he was at the same time faced with death, which is always destroys every man's ultimate potency. Faced with a death that he did not know when would come, although he knew it was coming. And this led him in his middle 60s to make the ultimate act that is a demonstration of man's potency against nature itself, namely the act of suicide. So long as you can hang on to the virtue of individual potency, you can laugh in the face of death. But once you lose this advantage, your choice is to accept death as it comes gradually and ignominiously, or rush headlong to meet it, as Hemingway did. Now, this ethos of the frontier, which is in every one of us who grew up in this country, became merged with Victorian industrialism. We had astonishing success, not only in subduing the West, but in our physical and industrial sciences. And in the late 19th and 20th centuries, these were to grow magnificently. As somebody who comes back to Michigan State after 30 years, I come back regularly, but every time I come back here, I discover what amazing advances our technology has made. Whether you've made the same advances in education or not, I am not in a position to say, although I very much hope so. Now, in this merging of industrialism with the potency of the West, a man gains strength by manipulating nature and then by manipulating also himself. But myself, if I manipulate it, is this inert hunk of living matter which submits to manipulation, and then I lose my potency precisely to the degree that I am able successfully to manipulate myself. And this is the first paradox that we notice, that the merging of industrialism and the methods of industrialism, I take nature with my hands, I cut it, I saw it, I mold it, I put it on freight cars, I send it here and there. This kind of pride in man, which was shifted to I can do the same thing with myself and with others, became a great part of our American problem. For it is exactly this kind of insistence on affirming potency, which in the long run destroys it. Now, there's another side to the relationship between sex and death in America. The obsession with sex serves to cover up contemporary man's fear of death. We in the 20th century have this universal fear, but we have fewer defenses against it than our ancestors. Defenses against it, such as the belief in immortality, or some widely accepted purpose for life. And would you observe how the repression of death in the 20th century in America is so amazingly like the Victorians' repression of sex? Death is obscene, it's unmentionable, it's pornographic. If sex was nasty, death is a nasty mistake. Death is not to be talked of in front of the children, nor talked about at all if we can help it. We dress death up in grotesquely colorful caskets, not unlike the voluminous dresses which covered everything below the neck of the Victorian woman. We throw flowers on the casket to make death smell better, with make-believe funerals and burial ceremonies, fancy tombs. We act as though somehow the deceased had not died. And we preach a psycho-religious gospel that says the less grief you feel, the better. Even our economy joins in the same physical repression of death. For we have try to arrange everything as though the deceased had not died by life insurance and number of other economic measures. This protecting the children, camouflaging smell and dress, these make-believe ceremonies, ending up in an inward pretense, all of this is an amazing parallel to how the Victorian repressed sex. Now, consequently, the awareness of death is widely repressed in our day, but none of us can fail to see that the same preoccupation, a tremendous preoccupation with sex, in our humor, it's essentially sexual. Our drama, our economic life, even down to the commercials on television. Now, whenever you have an obsession which drains off anxiety from one area, prevents a person from confronting something distasteful, you have to ask, where does this draw off? Where does this anxiety come out again? And I am here to say this afternoon that this anxiety comes out in a preoccupation in our society with sexuality. Now, when I strive to prove my potency in order to silence my inner fears of impotence, I'm engaging in a pattern that's as old as man himself. Death is the symbol of ultimate finiteness, the symbol of the loss of potency, and anxiety arising from this inescapable experience calls forth the struggle to make ourselves infinite by way of sex. Death is a symbol of ultimate impotence, and sexual activity is the most ready way to silence the inner dread of death, and through the symbol of procreation, to triumph over it. Now, there is some realistic basis for this, because there's a biological base in sexuality and procreation. We do have children. We pass on our name. We save our blood. It lives somehow in the genes in our children. But as I've said, whenever there's a repression of an important biological or emotional aspect of experience, there is an equivalent development of inner anxiety which has to come out some other way. And I believe this comes out in our preoccupation in this country with the symbols and the reality of sex. Repression of death equals obsession with sex. Sex is the easiest way to prove our vitality. It's the easiest way to demonstrate I'm not yet dead. I'm virile. I'm potent. And it carries the weight of asserting our ultimate potency even over nature. Now, these are serious problems that confront our development, particularly in America, and they result in several different paradoxes that come out in our sexual roles. I want to talk these paradoxes over with you now for a few minutes. You recall in Victorian times when the denial of sexual impulses, feelings, and drives was the mode, no one would talk about sex. And the whole subject was surrounded by a sanctifying repulsiveness, an aura that you didn't touch it. But then, as you have heard, I don't need to go into the data, there was a radical change in the 1920s. No matter how much discussion of the fact that virginity hasn't increased all that much, I mean it has decreased all that much, that nevertheless is true that there was a radical change in the attitude of Americans towards sex. The belief became a militant dogma in liberal circles that the opposite to repression, namely sex education, freedom of talking about it, expression of sexuality, all of these would have healthy effects. And they obviously constituted the only a sane stand for the enlightened person. Now, it's amazing that that happened in 10 short years after World War I. We became more preoccupied with sex, scholars believe, than any other nation that has ever existed. Now, as a result of this radical shift, many of us psychotherapists, analysts of all sorts, today very rarely see people who experience repression of sex in the manner of Freud's pre-War I hysterical patients. In fact, we find just the opposite among the patients who come to us. We find a great deal of talk about sex, a great deal of sexual activity, practically no one complaining about cultural prohibitions over going to bed with this many or whatever women as he chooses. But what our patients do complain of is lack of feeling and passion. The curious thing about this ferment of discussion is how little anybody seems to be enjoying emancipation. So much sex and so little meaning or even fun in it. And this is where the industrialism, with its ideal of the machine, its mechanization that destroys humanity, becomes expressive in our very attitudes toward sexuality. Now, the Victorian didn't want anybody to know that he or she had sexual feelings, but we are ashamed if we don't have them. Before 1910, if you called a woman sexy, she would be insulted. Nowadays, if you call her this, she prizes the compliment, and she turns her charms more in your direction. Our patients often have the problems of impotence and frigidity, but the strange and sad thing is, as they lie on the couch or sit in the chair, is how hard they struggle not to let that out, how hard they struggle not to let anyone see that they don't feel sexually. The Victorian nice man or woman was guilty if he or she did experience sex, and now we are guilty if we don't. Now, this makes another paradox that we must face, namely that enlightenment has not at all solved the sexual problems in our culture. To be sure, there are important positive results of this new enlightenment, chiefly in the increased freedom for the individual. Most external problems are eased. Sexual knowledge can be bought in any bookstore. Contraception is available any place in the country except Boston. And there they still believe, as the British Countess said to her husband on the wedding night, that this is too good for the common people. Couples can, without guilt and without squeamishness, talk over how their relationship goes and can make it mutually gratifying and meaningful. Now, I don't want to underestimate these gains at all. External social anxiety and guilt have lessened, and dull would be the man who did not rejoice in this. But the trouble is that internalized guilt and anxiety have increased. And in some ways, in most ways, these are more morbid, harder to handle, and impose a heavier burden upon the individual in his own quest for identity than does external guilt and anxiety. The challenge a woman used to face was very simple. Would she or would she not go to bed? This is a direct issue of how you stood vis-a-vis cultural mores. But the question now men ask about women is not that. The question is not will she or won't she, but can she or can't she? This is the emphasis that has become a tyranny, so some of my colleagues in New York think, on the orgasm. Tyranny of the Orgasm was a paper by a friend of mine in New York, Dr. Leslie Farber. The challenge is shifted from the outside to the inside, to the woman's and the man's personal adequacy. And this makes the problem of potency much more difficult. She must be able to have the vaunted orgasm and apparently have it as though she were having a grand mal seizure. Now, I believe all of these things are misplaced paradoxes that come out of our, if I may say so, lopsided history with respect to the problem of potency and impotence. Now, I would agree that to put the question inside is better than to have it outside. But what people don't understand is it makes it harder to face if it's inside. See, in past decades, you could simply blame society's mores. You could say, if you don't choose to go to bed with somebody, you can say, well, this is, my parents wouldn't like it, or something of that sort. This gives you time to decide what you want to do. See, the strange thing about rules is that every culture must have them, and they perform a very useful function, whether you obey them or not. Namely, they give you time to decide. They give you time to ponder, decide what you really want to do, and decide to grow into a decision. But when the question is simply, how can you perform? Your own sense of adequacy and self-esteem is called immediately into question. And the whole weight of the encounter is shifted inward to how you can meet the test. And this begins our whole struggle. Everybody is being tested in sexuality. Male tests the female tests the male, until one wonders how the spontaneity of this most spontaneous act can be preserved. Now, in this merging of Victorian industrialism with the myth of the frontier, there came another dilemma, another paradox, and that is that our new emphasis on technique in sex and lovemaking backfires. It often seems to me that there's an inverse relationship between how many books you read and how much pleasure and fun you get out of sexuality. I think this is true in a society, too. I don't want to make that too extreme. I still think it's good if you know something about sexuality and what goes on. But there's nothing wrong with knowing about technique, whether it's playing golf or dancing or making love. But the emphasis upon technique beyond a certain point results in a mechanistic attitude. A mechanistic attitude toward lovemaking, and this goes along with feelings of alienation, with feelings of loneliness, and with depersonalization. And this leads to the very curious thing that I've often noticed in working with patients, that people are more shy about revealing what goes on within them psychologically, that is, their fantasies, their hopes, their fears, their plans for the future, than they are about physical nakedness. It's harder to become spiritually and psychologically naked in our day than the simple physical nakedness of sexual relationship. Now, there's a third, or fourth actually, paradox that comes out of our vaunted sexual freedom. And that is that it turned out to be a new kind of Puritanism. Now, I hasten to define what I mean by Puritanism. It's a state of alienation of the self from the body. It's a separation of emotion and reason, and it's the use of the body as a machine. These were the aspects of industrialism as it became merged with Puritanism in the 19th century. And it's also the form of moral Puritanism that existed in this country until fairly recently. But in sex, there's the same old, there's the same sexual expression, but now it's pro-Puritan, alienation from body and the feeling, exploitation of the body as though it were a machine, as the body is that instrument by which I prove that I am potent and that I am I'm young, I'm not dead yet, and that I am virile. In our new Puritanism, bad health is equated with sin. Sin used to be to give in to one's sexual desires, and now it is not to have full sexual expression. Now it's considered immoral in sophisticated circles not to express your libido. A woman used to feel guilty if she went to bed with a man, and now she feels vaguely uneasy if after a certain number of dates she still refrains. And the partner generally appears to be, pretend he's broad-minded, and that on her, about her sin of not giving and her sin of morbid repression. And he stands around always ready at the end of an evening to help her out of her fallen state. Now, this makes the guilt all the more difficult to face underneath the surface. What this means is that people have to learn to perform sexually to make sure they can exhibit their potency without ever letting themselves be passionate, without ever letting themselves commit themselves. For commitment can be interpreted as an unseemly demand on the partner. The Victorian person sought to make love without falling into sex, and the modern person seeks to have sex without falling in love. Now, if you want an example of this, let me give you one directly from the top of my head, namely this great journal that sweeps the campuses throughout the country and no doubt Michigan State University, namely Playboy. Now, Playboy, when you open it, seems to be a magazine for liberation. You see these tremendous pictures of girls' bodies with tremendous breasts, and you get the idea that this is on the right track because Hefner and everybody associated with them is all for the new freedom. But if you look farther, you will discover that on the expression on the faces of these girls is very detached. It is not at all sexual, and they turn out to be, and this I know from some of my colleagues who've analyzed some of these girls in New York City, that what you discover is that they are lesbian often. They don't have any interest in sex with men. And one gets more and more the feeling as one looks more carefully at them. It's not a sexual magazine at all. And then what you read, as of one of the copy I opened up the other day, what you read in the, let's begin with the letters to the editor in the front part. I read first a letter from a minister pointing out how good Playboy is for his congregation and how the chief readers of Playboy in this country are the college students and the ministers. He is very proud of this, and he points out how one ought to use Playboy in one's church services. Now, the important thing here is the word ought to, because that's the new Puritanism. This now becomes the crusade. Then we read a little farther, and we discover in a letter to the editor that some ministers holding that caption, Jesus was a playboy. And Jesus was a playboy because Jesus loved Mary Magdalene and a few other women, and he liked great meals, and so on and so forth. Now, the point I want to make in all of this is that, now this is all united with the fact that Playboy has very good articles, which you always can get, incidentally, if you hire a very good editor and pay enough money. It has these good articles, and the search is to merge these the excellent intellect of the American writers with the kind of sexual freedom that actually turns out to be a new kind of ought. One ought to be according to Playboy. Now, in my judgment, Playboy, the success of Playboy is due to the fact that Hefner, consciously or unconsciously, very cleverly caught on to the capitalizing on the American fear of impotence. Playboy never has an ad for bald heads. There's no bald head in Playboy. There never is a truss. There never is a crutch. All the way through, there is continued this illusion that the modern American man is very powerful, strong, and potent, but he never commits himself. You notice in the jokes and in the articles and so on, there's always this playing up with the illusion of my strength, but my strength never committing myself to a woman. Now, this is the ultimate form of impotence, the inability to commit yourself to a relationship, whatever you do sexually. Now, I don't want to overstate my case, nor to lose sight at any point of the positive benefits of the modern change in sexual mores. The confusions I'm describing go hand in hand with real possibilities of freedom for the individual. Couples are able to affirm sex as a way of relationship, as a way of meaning between them, as they never were able in Victorian times. There's the possibility of developing a courage that's midway between and includes both biological lust on one hand and meaningful relationship on the other. A deepening awareness of each other and the other aspects of what we call human understanding. Courage can be shifted, the whole battle can be shifted from fighting sexual society's mores to the battle of the capacity to commit oneself to another human being. But these positive benefits, I think it's now completely clear, do not come automatically. They become possible only as a person has faced the paradoxes and has been able, with courage, to work them through. And now I want to press our discussion a little deeper and ask, what are the motives that lie behind these paradoxes that whose source we have seen? The struggle to prove one's identity is obviously a central motive. This is an aim present in women as well as men. Betty Friedan proved this very clearly in The Feminine Mystique, if it needed to be proved. This has helped spawn the idea of egalitarianism of the sexes and the interchangeability of the sexual roles. Egalitarianism is clung to at the price of denying not only biological differences, which are basic, certainly to say the least, biological differences between man and woman, but emotional differences from which come much of the delight of the sexual act. The self-contradiction that's present in this egalitarianism is the compulsive need to prove you are identical with your partner. Everything he feels, you feel, or you feel, she feels. But to prove you're identical with your partner exactly destroys your identity. This is the contribution that contributes to the tendency in our society for us to become machines, even in bed. Now, a patient of mine came in a couple of weeks ago with the following very graphic dream. He said, I'm in bed in this dream with my wife, and between us is my accountant. He's going to have sexual relations with my wife. My feeling about this is odd, only that somehow it seemed appropriate. Now, it's very curious that this man's accountant is there in bed about to perform what used to be called a nuptial act with the man's wife. It's even more important that he doesn't have any feeling about it. This is the mechanical man that I've been talking about. This is what happens when sex is made into a machine way of feeling. But what is interesting specifically for us is the fact that it's the accountant, not the boss or somebody or other else. And this, to my mind, demonstrates the great concern in our day with timetables, timetable in lovemaking. This was a practice confirmed by and standardized by Kinsey. If they fall behind the schedule, they become anxious. They feel impelled to go to bed whether they want to or not. The man feels he's somehow losing his masculine status if he does not perform often enough. The woman achieves lost her feminine attractiveness if too long a period goes by without her man friend at least making a pass at her. There are elaborate ledger books that get carried on unconsciously among these couples. How often have we made love? Did he or she pay the right amount of attention to me beforehand? Was the foreplay long enough? And all of these aspects of the technicalization of sexual relationship. Now, I believe that it is very important that we, in our reaction against the overemphasis on the difference between the sexes and also the inferiority that we held, a fictitious inferiority about women and her sexual feelings, in our reaction against that, we must not throw out the baby with the bathwater. We must not throw out biology. In the Victorian period, the pattern was that the man show he's strong, he was a kind of cannibal, he should assert himself like a caveman, and the stereotype of the woman. This man must not only control himself and manipulate himself, but every woman that comes along in his path. The stereotype of the woman was a gentle, sweet-smelling creature, unable to take care of herself, unable to survive hearing profanity, and ready to swoon at the earliest possible excuse. Now, this was all phony. And I think it's a phoniness of a period that was moving toward a radical change in its sexual mores. But our reaction against this, the cry then became no longer "Viva la difference," but the rallying cry became "Everybody feels the same." But we found to our horror that we had thrown out the delightful, the ecstasy-giving aspects of sexual relationship along with the unfair suppression. Now, identity requires one's biological self. Identity requires that you ask, what am I? What am I as, on as deep a level as I can get? And this level must go below the cultural level. Now, I know the cultural level is tremendously important. I would not for a moment disparage it. But I also believe the biological level is important, and that you will be most your identity. You will find your identity most usefully, a man or a woman, if you are what, as we used to say in my day, what God made you to be. There are differences in the masculine and feminine musculature. So the Belgian psychologist Buitendijk concludes. He points out that men are built on a square basis. Their bones and muscles are fitted at right angles. This is the better to thrust, all the better to punch, to poke for assertive aspects of the male's role. The woman, he points out, is built on curves, rounded lines, the better to open herself, to carry the offspring, to give the peculiar kind of pleasure, and to enjoy the peculiar kind of pleasure that is feminine. You already can see this thrusting mechanism in the little boy. And I believe that this is this must be a biological fact to begin with, no matter how it's treated culturally. When somebody digs a skeleton 500 years old up the lake here on the way to Detroit, the doctors can tell immediately, is that a male or a female? Now, what I am proposing is not at all the old inferiority-superiority, because I think it's more difficult to grow up as a male in our society than it is a female. If that were so, we ought to simply reverse the idealization. But our society wrongly associates masculine virtues with action and feminine virtues with passivity, which is certainly wrong and misleading. Actually, both masculine and feminine are active and passive in their own way. Now, what I propose, and I realize many of you have will not agree with this, but I propose it anyway as the basic truth as I see it, is that identity requires you start where you are. And though there are tendencies toward becoming more feminine, which I believe American men certainly should become, American men should cry, American men should be gentle, tender, and women should move toward the so-called male idea. We have used these against each other, quite wrongly. Nevertheless, I believe that there is such a thing as a biological basis, and this must be assimilated by you, and your own identity must be assimilated by you precisely that you may get the greatest joy out of love and its different aspects. Now, there's another motive that I wish to propose to you. And this is that the motive of for this paradoxes in sexual behavior, sexual role that I've discussed. And this is the motive that's allied with the desperate feelings of loneliness, of emptiness, the threat of apathy that is so apparent in our age. If one can fall in love with somebody, no, not fall in love. If one can have sexual relations with somebody, if one can make somebody else feel something, if you can make somebody else react, then you have, to some extent, proven that you yourself are not dead yet. You still have an effect on somebody. And couples go, or people go through life, each time trying to find somebody that they can get some feeling out of. They seek an answering quiver in somebody else's body to prove their own is not dead. And they seek a responding, a longing in the other to prove their own feelings are still alive. And out of an ancient conceit, this is often called love. Now, one gets the impression, amid all this male and female flexing of sexual prowess, that people are in training to become sexual athletes. But what's the great prize of the game? The men and the women must struggle to keep up the timetable and to have the wanted orgasm. And I can only say to you that it's well understood in psychotherapeutic circles that the endeavor to prove prowess is exactly the product of one's fear that one doesn't have it. There's one's fear of impotence. The use of sex to prove potency in all these different realms has led to an increasing emphasis on the technical performance. The excessive concern with technical performance in sex actually is correlated with reduction of sexual feeling. And the upshot of this is that the man who then can perform the best sexually is the man who is impotent. I had some very interesting experiences with some patients recently that I am talking from, that I'm telling you about. One man had been very much afraid of sexual impotence, so he'd gone to the doctor who happened to live next door, a urologist, and this urologist had prescribed an ointment that this man was to put on his penis, and he'd feel less when he was making love with his wife, and therefore he could he wouldn't have premature ejaculation, and he could perform better. Now, the very curious thing that struck me was this chap accepted this as a perfect answer to his problem. He had no objections at all. The idea that was important to him was that he must show himself to be an adequate representative of his role as a husband, and this ointment seemed to do the trick. Now, since then, other psychoanalysts have told me they've had the same experience. Now, this is perhaps a common thing among urologists, heaven help us. I think being able to make oneself feel less in order to perform better is a macabre symbol of the vicious circle in which so much of our culture is caught. The more one must demonstrate his potency, the more he treats sexual intercourse, which is the most intimate and personal of all acts, as a performance to be judged by outside requirements, the more he then views himself as a machine to be turned on, adjusted, steered, the less feeling he has either for himself or for his partner. And the less feeling he has, the more he loses his genuine sexual appetite and ability. And the upshot of this self-defeating pattern is that in the long run, the lover who is most efficient is also the one who is impotent. Now, what I've been trying to say to you leads to a strange asceticism in our country that you probably aren't aware of too much out here now, but as a psychoanalyst who deals with these problems before they become conscious in society, I want to say that I think it's a real problem in our society. David Riesman, you recall, in The Lonely Crowd, said sex is the last frontier. Gerald Sykes, in the same vein, remarks, in a world gone gray with market reports, time studies, tack regulations, and path lab analyses, the rebel finds sex to be the one green thing. Now, it's surely true that the zest, the adventure, the trying out of one's strength, the discovering of vast and exciting new areas of feeling and experience in oneself and in one's relationship to others, this is a validation of the self. And this goes with experiences which are indeed frontier experiences. They were rightly and normally present in sexuality as part of the social, psychological, and sexual development of every person. Now, our society did have these characteristics for a few decades after the 1920s. Almost everything else was jaded, other-directed, became emptied of zest and adventure. But for various reasons, and I think the main one is, that sex has had to carry the freight for everything. Sex has carried the freight for repression of death, for a proof of strength. Sex has, in this sense, lost its frontier freshness, its newness, and become more and more empty. Now, in this loss, actually, of asceticism, of sex, and the trend toward a new asceticism, which you may notice more than, you may notice this more in the future years, incidentally. I think this is why a number of the statistics don't show a greater actual sexual behavior. But people are now, in the very avant-garde, are now turning against the whole idea. Sex moved from an anesthetic attitude in which we don't feel to an antiseptic one in which we steer clear. Sexual contact itself then tends to be avoided. Now, I think this is the least constructive aspect of the new Puritanism. It ends up finally with a new asceticism. I think that's the ultimate impact of Playboy, a new asceticism. Now, this is illustrated beautifully in a limerick that somebody on the West Coast, some college campus, once wrote. His limerick goes like this. The word has come down from the dean that with the aid of the teaching machine, King Oedipus Rex could have learned about sex without ever touching the queen. Now, I want to conclude my remarks today with something about possible answers. This was not my assignment, but I feel that if I leave you as negatively, as most of you now feel, I will have left you too negatively. So let me try to point out how I think some of these things are going to be met. Then in the next couple of days, you will discuss this more. I think in the first place, it is necessary that, as I have tried to say today, that we affirm persons in terms of their unique capacities and even in terms of their differences. The idea of marrying somebody just like you, dating somebody like you, as I am told the computer works it out, is horrifying. The more one experiences the value of differences, differences of color, differences of experience, differences of background, it seems to me the more one can appreciate these unique capacities in human beings. In sexual intercourse, there is then a polar relationship, a rhythmic polar relationship, that is more than just a method of sexual intercourse. This is why the Chinese said in one of their proverbs, ancient Chinese, that sexual intercourse is the human form of the creative cosmic process. In the sexual act is the most powerful enactment of relatedness imaginable, for it is the drama of approach, entrance, full union, then partial separation, as though the lovers could not believe it were true and yearned to look at each other, then confirmed in the complete reunion again. It cannot be an accident of nature that in sex we thus enact the sacrament of intimacy and withdrawal, union and distance, separating ourselves and giving ourselves in full union again. For this is an eternal repeated participation in each other. The touch and the withdrawal is present even in the hesitant beginnings of acquaintanceship. It's in the essence of courtship, even in birds and animals, as well as men and women. In the rhythm of participation in a union of a dual being, and the withdrawal into individual autonomy again, in these two are contained the two necessary poles of human existence itself. Now, a second suggestion is that we must learn, and I'm becoming Puritan myself, that it is advisable that we learn, if I can talk as a psychologist, that sex is a communication of meaning between people. Man is the only creature who makes love face to face, who copulates looking at his partner. Yes, we can turn our heads, or we can assume other positions for a variety's sake. But these are variations on a theme, the theme of making love vis-a-vis each other. This opens the whole front of the person, the breast, the chest, the stomach, all the parts that are most associated with tenderness and gentleness. This opens them to the kindness or to the cruelty of the parent. The man can thus see in the eyes of the woman the nuances of delight or awe, the tremulousness or the angst. It's the posture of the ultimate bearing of oneself. This is why Teilhard de Chardin has written, "We are most ourselves," he wrote this about actually sexual love, we are most ourselves when we lose ourselves. And then there is, it seems to me necessary also, the experience of sex as personal. This marks, making love face to face marks the emergence in man as a psychological creature of the personal creature. It's a shift from animal to man. Even monkeys mount from the rear. The consequence of this change is very great indeed. It stamps the love act forever as personal, with all the implications of that fact, one of which being that lovers can speak to each other, they can share, and the speaking that is done without words is generally the most meaningful. It's an accentuation of intimacy in giving the side closest to ourselves in the sexual experience. The two chords of lovemaking, one's experience of oneself and one's experience of the partner, are here temporarily merged. We feel our own delight and passion, and we look into the eyes of the partner. They're often reading the meaning of the act for him or her, and often we cannot tell the difference. Now, this is the normal state in the genuine meaning of sexual love. The looking is fraught with intensity. It brings a heightened consciousness of relationship and the meaning of the relationship. Now, I hope in this affirming of personal, of unique capacities, in this individual communication, and in the acceptance and affirmation of sexual love as a personal act, that you can and we can rediscover the meaning of sexuality. So it will be as it was in the proverb of the ancient Chinese, the human form of the cosmic creative process. Thank you.